Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by Christopher Cotter and myself, David Robertson. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com. Today we're joined by Professor Callum Brown, who's the Professor of Religious and Cultural History at the University of Dundee. I'm not going to tell you too much about the work that he's done, because we're going to be talking about that in the interview today, but Professor Callum Brown is a historian. He's the author of a number of works, including The Death of Christian Britain and the forthcoming book Religion and the Demographic Revolution: Women and Secularization in Canada, Ireland, UK and USA since the 1960s. So first of all, welcome Professor Brown.
Pleased to be here.
Thank you. It's lovely to have you. We're here at the University of Edinburgh recording this today. Before we get into the depths of things, we're going to be talking about basically historical approaches to the study of religion and to your own particular specialization, which is the history of secularization. We haven't had a historian yet on the podcast, so I was wondering if we could get right down to basics and just tell me a little bit about history and what is the discipline of history. We've all got an idea of what it is from school. I only did history till I was 14 and abandoned it pretty quickly after that. So a bit of an idea of what history is.
Well, I think history is perhaps on one level self-evidence about the past. On a second level, history is by far the most complicated and comprehensive discipline in all the academy, because historians have the duty of writing the history of every conceivable topic, from history of sciences, medicine, history of ditch digging, all the way through to history of diplomacy, history of war, history of religion. So in that regard, history is a hugely diverse discipline. Departments of history, degrees of history, can be incredibly complex and varied in terms of geography, time period, and approach. I think the best way to think about history is to think of different sub-disciplines. And there are endless numbers of those, but the ones which are of greatest interest to anybody studying religion, I think, are ecclesiastical history, or church history, which started off as history of institutions, history of the Reformation, and something which of course is pursued with great vigour here in New College Edinburgh. There then developed in the mid-20th century the social history of religion, which sprang up as a joint enterprise really between ecclesiastical historians coming from a confessional background, who were being educated, if you like, by rising social history and sociology in mid-20th century, and were interested in the social context of religion and the impact of environmental factors upon the development of religion in the past. The other part of social history of religion was promoted by those coming from social history, which it was often quite radical. Mid-20th century, we're talking about socialist historians like E.B. Thompson and his wife Dorothy, who were both very interested in religion in Scotland. Alan MacLaren, who wrote a pathbreaking book on a class analysis of the disruption of 1843 in Aberdeen, and a number of others. That was very, very fashionable approach in the 1960s, 1970s, and into the 80s. And indeed, that's where I sprang from when I was both an undergraduate and postgraduate student in the 1970s. Everything that I had to read was really coming from either church history or was coming from social history of religion. Really, in the last 30 years, from the 1980s, a new approach has sprung up, almost to dominate or even to kind of infuse its way into the rest of the study of religion, and that's cultural history. The examination of, broadly speaking, the cultural circumstances in which religion exists, religion as a part of culture, the way in which religion is sustained, or in some cases perhaps undermined, by discourse, by looking at the way in which religion is a set of messages about idealized behavior, about, as Foucault described it, do this and not do that, the kind of bipolarity of discourse, and examining how that, in religious terms, is distributed through media, through everyday existence, through sexual identities, and conversely, how those may have changed. My own interest in history has been really for most of my career in secularisation, that is the decline of religion. And the vast bulk of people who are interested in that mostly study either the 19th or the 20th and now the 21st centuries. So broadly speaking, I think history is a vast array of disciplines which does borrow theoretically from sociology, from historians themselves, but often from areas such as anthropology, from discourse analysis. I've certainly borrowed from their ideas about more broadly postmodernism. There aren't that many postmodern historians of religion that I know of. Or certainly not that many that I would know would put their hand up to that description, though they will use what I might describe as postmodern method.
Okay. That's been a really good introductory overview there. People might know that, well, we're sponsored by the British Association for the Study of Religions. They're the sponsor of this podcast. And it used to be called the British Association for the History of Religions. The main international academic body for religious studies is still called the International Association for the History of Religions. So religious studies itself, as a discipline, is very bound up with this idea of historical study. And I certainly found when I was over in Budapest at the European Association conference in September that a lot of the dominant academic discourse in Europe at the moment is certainly much more historical than what we're maybe used to in Anglophone contexts. Before we start using your work as an example of applying the historical approach, when I'm thinking about history, I'm thinking sort of source criticism. We were all, you know, we were presented with various written sources and told, you know, who wrote the source, how valid can you take that source to be. There must be a whole other array of methodological approaches that are there for the historian to use. I'm not saying that any historian is going to be defined by one or the other, but could you give us a taste of some of the different approaches that a historian can take to looking at, well, we're looking at religion, so looking at it in history.
Well, one I've already mentioned is the cultural history approach, which is still not that fashionable amongst historians, but it has grown significantly. One area where the cultural history approach in relation to religion has always been at the forefront, and that's in women's history. Mm-hmm. Women's historians have been very interested in the social history of religion because of the power of religious rhetoric and discourse to subordinate women throughout Christian history. And that work really advanced tremendously in the 1970s and the 1980s. And you can't really think of a woman's historian looking at the area of women's subordination without them at some point engaging with issues of religion as an underlying philosophical and sometimes even a kind of mechanical bulwark to women's subordination. In the early part of my career, devoted a great deal of attention to the role of Kirk Sessions in Scotland in the 18th and 19th centuries, investigating fornication, the bread and butter of Scottish Kirk Session business for centuries, in which basically they were focusing attention primarily on women. Fornication usually came to light in Scotland as a result of somebody spotting or suspecting that a woman was pregnant out of wedlock, whereupon a woman was called before a court session and requested forcefully to confess, and more importantly, to name the father of the child.
Mm.
So I spent a lot of time looking at that system, and there's still studies being made of that. Other methods are quite varied. In recent work, in studying the 20th century, historians of religion are moving into a wide variety of different approaches. Well, one is to look at traditional institutional role of religion in the state. Give you an example. In the study of the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, areas such as the decriminalisation of homosexuality, the legalisation of medical abortion, church figures were quite important, both for and against those trends. And there's been recent work, notably by Hugh MacLeod, into the forces behind the decriminalisation of homosexuality within the Church of England, who were extremely influential upon the Wolfenden Committee in the 1950s. So you can undertake, if you like, conventional analysis of how religious change is impacting upon the public sphere, upon the state. But at the same time of increasing interest and use by historians, looking at the 20th century has been the study of people's personal testimony. And if you're going to study social history properly, that is the history of the people in relation to religion, you need to get down to personal testimony and not just rely, as one tends to be in studying the 19th century and earlier, upon church reports of what people are doing in relation to religion. It's almost second hand. If you read some of the great masters of 19th century church history, social history of religion, such as E.R. Wickham, K.F. Inglis, even Alan MacLaren in Scotland, their sources tend to be Kirk Session, church records, church courts, or the memoirs of clergy, saying, well, I preached the congregation today and there wasn't a single working man there because they were all dressed in fine middle class clothes. The new methods of analysis in the 70s and the 80s quickly showed that these presumptions based on those kind of sources were wrong. Colleague of mine from the West of Scotland, Peter Hillis, did a PhD in the 1970s where he examined the actual social class occupations of somewhere in the region of 12,000, I think it was, individuals in Presbyterian churches in the West of Scotland. Then later on, subsequent decades, he extended this analysis throughout Scotland. And he was able to show very convincingly that somewhere like a minimum of 57% of churchgoers in the 19th century were working class.
Yeah.
The ministers standing in the pulpit were just wrong, and they were being fooled because working people were wearing fine clothes on a Sunday. So that's a starting to use a different method.
Yes.
Another method, one which I favour a great deal, is the use of oral history.
Okay.
It's going interviewing generally older people, not necessarily, but for the historians, it tends to be older people, about their recollections of religion and youth, their journey through life, changes. And, a project I'm working on is, at the moment, is an oral history of how people have lost religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been interviewing people on both sides of the Atlantic, looking at circumstances when they have left organized religion or belief, what age, whether they were affected by personal trauma, the education system, by reason, by reading Richard Dawkins, or being thumped on the head by somebody. So far I've interviewed 66 people,
mm-hmm.
doing what's called a whole life interview technique, which is started basically at birth. What did your parents do? Did they go to church? Tell us about your grandparents, and then moving all the way through, tracing all the interesting features of age and circumstance and community. I've interviewed several people from Northern Ireland, for instance, and the impact of community upon their religiosity process is very acute and very different from, say, people brought up in Edinburgh or Vancouver. So I mean, using oral history can be an interesting technique. The other technique, which we might get onto shortly, is the use of statistics and study of demography, which is not very fashionable amongst historians of religion, but I hope that will change shortly.
Why do you think it's not fashionable?
Basically because the vast bulk of historians can't count. To do something like demography, you have got to engage with a highly technical discipline, which is based on often on advanced statistical techniques. You've got to often know something about correlation or regression analysis, and certainly to be familiar with demographic categories of the birth, marriage, death. Although I'm less interested in death, but I'm very interested in birth, marriage, and coupling. And that, I think, scares many historians. One or two have used correlations in the past. Hume Cloud, another historian I must mention again, who way back in his PhD in the early 70s publishes a book in 1974, a study of Victorian London. He used correlations to show apparently how the church going was strongest in those parts of London which had the highest number of baths per household and the highest number of servants, thereby being able to argue that religion was something which was strongly middle class, bigger proportion of more middle class than working class. But by and large, most historians of religion don't even understand what Hume Cloud did. In that regard, they tend to be more au fait with what you do with traditional documentary sources and making an argument essentially from example. Demography leads you to making an argument if you get the right data from the total population. When you get census data, which allows you to look the numbers who tick a box saying I am Church of Scotland, with the same people ticking boxes about number of toilets they've got in their house, how many cars they own, what their occupation is, what age they got married, and so forth, then you're talking about trying to be able to draw up a demographic picture of the type of people who go to church, who stop going to church, and so on. And you can get quite sophisticated if you get the data.
The previous interview that I did was a couple of weeks ago with Ariella Kazar from Trinity College, Massachusetts, who is one of the people responsible for the American Religious Identification Survey. So we've heard all about the problems with trying to administer demographic surveys in the contemporary context, but going back to historical context, it's all dependent upon who was answering the questions, what the question asked was, and
master surveys using what I've been using is government census. Everybody fills in a government census, except for those who criminally evade. The problem in Britain has been that the British census has not asked people about religion until 2001. If you exclude the church-going census of 30th March 1851, which was a rainy day. But Canada's asked it since 1871, every 10 years, which is a lovely set of data. Australia since 1906. The United States has not asked it because it's unconstitutional for the state to be asking people about religion, but there are ways of using the data there. New Zealand has also asked since the start of the 20th century. Ireland since the end of the 19th century. Once you've got census data which covers the entire population, then you can correlate with their answers to other questions in the census. How many children do you have? The size of your household? What's your occupation? Etc., etc., etc. And then you're laughing because you can start to correlate. Now, even when you lack this information, as you do for the UK, there are still ways around this. You can still do what are called snapshot analysis. Just pick a moment in time when you have got data on religion from the past and see where the nearest data is from census, and you can make snapshot pictures rather than time series. So there are ways around it. And demography, I think, is very important. And the reason I think it is important is because in studying secularisation hitherto, the dominant approach, almost overwhelmingly, is the notion that people stop believing or stop going to church.
Yeah.
You know, if you scratch a historian of secularisation or even somebody who's interested in the religious studies field, it's one of those two things they're really talking about. Either stop going to church or being a member of a church or getting child baptised or getting married in a church, or you stop believing, or you start believing something else.
Yeah.
If you start looking at demography, as I've been doing for the last 3 years, you start seeing a lot of other things. You start seeing people developing an entirely new sense of self, because they change fundamentally the way they live their lives, depending on whether or not they are churchgoers and what church they go to. I found strong differences of family formation patterns, depending on whether they went to a conservative Christian church or a liberal, or in the United States, mainline church. I've noticed differences depending on whether they are heterosexual or gay. There's very strong correlation between, for instance, in Britain in 2001, between being gay and being somebody who ticked the box in the 2001 census as of no religion.
Mm-hmm.
Equally, there's a strong correlation between cohabitation and not being a member of a church,
yeah,
or being of a liberal rather than a conservative church. A whole series of demographic patterns open up. The most strident of these, which the book is about, is the difference in women's behaviour, depending on their religiosity, their age of marriage, their age at which they have the first child, number of children they have, all show very, very strong patterns determined by whether or not they go to a church or not, and if they do go to a church, whether it's a liberal or a conservative.
Yeah.
And I regard this as an entirely vital area of understanding secularisation over the last 70 years. If we don't understand how the decline of religion in society and the culture relates to how people are changing their identities in terms of family formation, their sexuality, whether they want to have careers rather than having babies, if we don't understand that, you're only scratching the surface, yeah, of what it is to lose religion. Losing religion is something that's foundational upon identity, and identity is much more than belief.
Yeah. Well, that has been a really stimulating introduction and overview of just how, firstly, how important it is to pay attention to religion. Religion relates to all these other factors, and how we can go about studying it historically. We're pushed for time a little bit, so I would just like to ask you one question with two parts. Firstly, what marks a historian's approach to religious phenomena out from other approaches? Presumably you prefer it to other approaches, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it, although I'll let you say that. And also, what do you think the future of this approach holds? I know that you have another phase of your own personal research, even if you want to relate it to your own direction, but thinking more widely as well. What's the future for historical study of religion?
Well, taking history as a methodology first, I think this is an area where there's a huge gap between historians of religion and sociologists of religion. And I will pick as my example of a sociologist of religion my good friend Steve Bruce at Aberdeen. The sociologist looks at the world as one which is governed by rules. In Steve Bruce's case, he's the leading advocate and defender of the theories of secularization, in broadly speaking, which is the linear long-term decline of religion in our world, accelerated by certain phenomena such as the Renaissance, particularly the Enlightenment, industrialization, urban living, so on. His research interest is mostly contemporary, but behind it he has his notion of historical change, which is a kind of a template which, for those who are devotees of theory of secularization, is kind of fixed. It's there, and what the research does is to exemplify where we're at now on this long curve, the decline of religion. And the sociological approach is very much kind of what I would call snapshot, a dominance of the snapshot approach, which is, well, let's look at the data from the 2001 census and let's correlate cohabitation with religiosity, which I also do. The historian does this in a different framework. The historian is interested fundamentally in finding out when a particular thing, in this case religion, changed. Not how it's changing now, but when it changed. If you've taken a course of history, my interest is really the last 200 years, 1800 to the present. That's my kind of field of vision. I'm interested in drawing graphs of change year by year in that period. Not taking some kind of linear thing, but actually getting the data, the evidence, getting lots of snapshots at different points to cross-section the time scale over 200 years and find out when did religious decline accelerate, when did it stall, what was the impact of World War, did the First World War and the Second World War, did that accelerate it or not? Thereby, the reasoning being, when you identify when religion changed, you then look at, well, what was the cause? When is that associated with why? The two questions go together. The sociologist is not interested, in my mind, in putting those two things together. If you'd asked me the same question 30 years ago about what I thought the future was for the historical method and study of secularization, I would have said, yeah, we're going to tell you guys in sociology and religious studies what it's about. And there were people, somebody who was at the forefront of my field in the early 1980s, an American called Jeff Cox, mm-hmm. who wrote a pathbreaking book on religious decline in London. But since then, I've learnt, sadly, that sociologists and historians don't talk to each other enough. We're not listening to each other. There's a lot of shouting. There's a lot of, you're wrong. I've had quite a number of sociologists say I'm wrong about the 1960s being a turning point, including Steve Bruce, who published a piece in British Journal of Sociology a couple of years back on that. And I, of course, think he's fundamentally wrong in saying I'm wrong. But I think it is a methodological gulf. There's a chasm. I believe that if history shows you when something changes, then it allows you to identify why. A historian does not take progress as inevitable, does not take any particular development as inevitable. It's an abdication of the historian's responsibility to take anything as inevitable. And lastly, what is different, what is foundationally different between a sociologist and a historian, is at root, a sociologist is in a predictive profession. It's a social science. It's supposed to have some kind of applied purpose. It's a truism that a historian stops now. It's bad for a historian to predict the future.
Yep.
And I generally won't be drawn on that. I will be drawn on saying, well, as things appear at the moment, there doesn't seem to be any prospect of a change to such and such. But I'm not going to say 10 years' time or 20 years' time, which sociologists tend to do, because they tend to take their graph lines and draw them on.
Yeah. Wonderful. And as someone who seems to be going in a sociological direction, I think it is very good that we have had this conversation today. But we'll have to stop there. Thank you so much for coming to talk with us. And we'll be certain to highlight the book and everything on the website as and when it becomes available. So thank you, Professor Brett.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Chris talking to Callum Brown about historical approaches to the study of religion, and, in keeping with our recent series on secularisation, ways in which historical approaches can tell us about the decline of religion in the West. Next week, something slightly different, I'll be talking to Julian Mitchell about religion and media, and specifically how it relates to violence, how the media often seeks to portray religious narratives as encouraging or engendering violence, but other times uses it as a tool of mediation. We're keen to hear from you on our Facebook page or on the website. If you have a specific comment about today's podcast or any other podcast, please do leave a comment, question on our on the website or indeed on the Facebook page. We've started now to ask for your questions for upcoming interviews on the Facebook page. Again, we'd love to hear from you. We really want to encourage this site as a site of discussion. If you've nothing specific to add, but you would like to support the project, please do like us on Facebook or rate us on iTunes. Preferably, that's the one we would like at the moment. And as always, thanks for listening.